Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. What do you mean when you say meme? On social media, a meme is a funny image. It spreads across social media like wildfire. But what does the word mean in the context of investing? Turns out there are meme stocks and now meme ETFs. Tim Ranzetta is with NextGen Personal Finance, and he's going to talk about this new trend. Establishing good habits is really, really, really important when it comes to your money. How do you go about doing that? I mean, it's easier said than done. Stephen Guise is an author, and he's got some really great ideas here. He is the author of Elastic Habits, How to Create Smarter Habits That Adapt to Your Day. Then, have your finances got you freaking out a little bit? If you're looking for some calm in your life, Manisha Thakur from Money Zen is here to talk about five tips. And putting a spotlight on another personal finance podcast, this one is all about tax, which I loathe as a topic, but believe deeply in its importance. We're going to talk to the tax chick. Her name is Amanda Doucette. And we're also going to talk to the author of a memoir about money. Monica Parker has written a book called Oops, I Forgot to Save Money. And it turns out I am not alone. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Everyone has habits, some good, some bad. I cannot imagine my life without them. I don't think any of us can when we really think about it. It would be so much work. Imagine if I had to decide what I was going to have for breakfast every day. I'd have to think about it instead of having just the same thing. Well, we know that the habits you have with your money can make an enormous difference to your life, both good and bad. How do you make the wiring of the human brain as it relates to habits? How do you make that work for you? Stephen Guise has a bunch of ideas here. He's written a bunch of books on habits, including Elastic Habits, How to Create Smarter Habits That Adapt to Your Day. He joins us now from Orlando, Florida. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce, how are you?
You talk about habits and how they apply to every single area of life. We're going to look through the lens of personal finance today, but I want to ask you first to define what you mean by elastic habits, because I got to tell you, it sounds like cheating. It sounds like elastic pants. It sounds like I can bend the rules. What do you mean by elastic habits?
Well, you really hit the nail on the head. It is cheating, and that's why it works, because typically when we set a goal or we try to do a habit, we set the single point that we try to hit. And if we don't hit that single mark, then what happens? We fail. We're off the wagon. We're back to square one. So an elastic habit eliminates that problem by saying, okay, instead of trying to hit this one spot, you can hit this one or this one or this one. It just gives us more options for success.
You begin your book with something you called the slump, which both excited me and horrified me in equal measure. You actually put yourself into a slump for something like 6 weeks. You didn't leave the house. You ate horrible food. Why did you do that?
I don't recommend it.
Thank you for living it for us so we don't have to.
Yeah, I just wanted to test the theory that an elastic habit system could bring me back from the dead, so to speak. So I
virtual dead. You weren't actually dead. You were only almost dead.
Right. I just had a bucket full of new bad habits that I formed in that 6 weeks, or started to form.
And it was helpful for you. It gave you a sense for how to emerge.
Well, yeah, it was my confidence in the system, because I'd written a previous book called Mini Habits, which this is kind of an expansion on. So I knew it was even better than the Mini Habit system. And I knew that worked for me. That changed my life already. So I thought, yeah, let's try this out.
One part of the system, or maybe this is two, lateral options and vertical targets. What do those phrases mean?
Right. So lateral options would be multiple ways to accomplish the habit. So if we're talking about finance, say you have an elastic habit for finance. It could be you could decrease your spending, you could increase your saving, or you could invest a little bit. Those would be three lateral options, three different ways to complete your elastic habit for the day. And then vertically, you could set different levels. Say saving, maybe you typically eat out twice a day. So you could have different levels of success. If you cook all of your meals at home, that could be the highest level of success, a great win. But maybe you eat out once, that would be like a moderate level win. Or maybe you still eat out twice, but you don't order as much or, you know, cut out a side to save money. So those would be three levels of victory.
So you're setting yourself up to win. You just want to be winning.
Exactly. The problem people have with habits is they make them all or nothing. And when it's nothing, not only is it demoralizing, but you're literally not making progress in the habit. You're stopping the progress that you've made.
You use this assertion, sorry to interrupt, this assertion that if you, because it's now making sense to me, if you miss days, your goals are too big.
Yeah, you should never miss a day. I mean, maybe you miss one day every once in a while, but you should never, ever miss 2 days in a row.
Interesting. Motivational snowballer. This concept, I think, connects. There's a very prominent personal finance principle on debt pay down called the debt snowball, where you attack the lowest balance credit card because of the psychological win you have of eliminating that to zero, and then you move up and up and up. Tell me about the motivational snowballer. We're Canadians, so we know from snowballs.
I live in Florida, so I've never seen one.
Oh my God.
No, I have, but good. Yeah. So the motivational snowball is exactly what it sounds like. It's a theory of building on success and trying to eliminate the small failures that demoralize us, because the more you succeed, the more likely you are to succeed in the future.
Display your habits and track your habits. What do you mean by those ideas?
I think that's really important, especially in today's world where we're all in our phones. I like the old school systems of displaying, like, you know, a wall calendar. But for habits, if you can display your habits on the wall, they become more tangible to you. And I think that's really important because they should be tangible. They're real things that can drastically improve your life. And if you only keep them as an idea in your head, they have to compete with 1,000, 3 million other ideas, you know? So when you place them on the wall, you say, these are special. These are important to me.
This is a really important distinction here, because for a generation, we have been talking about displaying our goals. And sometimes that's in words, sometimes that's in a vision board, but you're talking about something different. You're actually talking about the action versus the result of the action.
Yes. And like I said,
you took a pause there. Like, I just reframed your life's work in the most profound way and led to your next book.
Well, we are kind of touching on my next book, but that's still a secret.
Okay, I won't say anything about it. But is that what you mean? You're going to track the habits. You're going to write it down. You're going to say, listen, my habit, my bronze level habit is I'm going to pack my lunch. My silver level habit is that I'm only going to eat out once a week. My gold level habit is I'm going to make my lunch and bring two portions and sell the second portion to my colleague. I just made that up right now.
Yeah, basically, because not only does it set that apart as special, but it also holds you accountable and reminds you.
How would you guide people to determine whether what they've developed is truly elastic in your definition, or whether they've actually snapped the elastic and what they're doing isn't sufficient to make any sustained difference in their financial life?
The most important thing when developing an elastic habit is to have distinct roles for each level. So I would say the most common problem people are going to have is they're going to say, I call it the mini level, the lowest level. they're going to make that too big. They're going to make it like a medium-sized level. And that each level serves its own purpose. So the elite top level, that's like your ideal habit, like your big win, what everyone wants. The middle level is when you don't really have that full push, that maximum energy, but you know, you can do some, you can do a good amount still. And the mini level is that purpose is to catch you when you're having a terrible day, basically, when you don't have any energy, when you feel discouraged. That's a safety net. So you want to have your levels designed in such a way to have each of those serve its purpose.
One of the models for habits that I'm familiar with is ability plus motivation plus trigger. You have a nuance to that and articulate three kinds of motivation: attainability, respectability, and value. We've just got about a minute left, but I'd love for you to give us some clarity on what you mean by those three things.
Yeah, those describe the three levels. So attainability, that's the mini level. It's you can always attain it. The middle level is respectability. It's not the best you can do, but it's respectable progress towards your goal. And then value is the, you know, that's the full value you want. That's the big win that everyone wants, but we can't always do that. And that's okay. That's why we have the other levels to catch us.
What are two or three habits for you in the area of personal finance? The rubber, you're walking the talk here. The rubber's hitting the road.
I use mint.com for my budgeting. So my mini habit is to look at that once a day. I can see where my money is going. That's really important. I can adjust the budget based on what I'm seeing. And then I would say another one would be investing. You can set up automatic investments. It's not exactly a habit because it's passive, but it kind of serves the same purpose of doing something small every day or every week. So you can just automatically have some money move into your investment account, or when it's in the investment account, you can move that into like the S&P 500.
Sure. Well, what's even more genius is when you've automated it, it's a habit and you literally had to do nothing to pull it off.
Right. It's like a pseudo habit that's done for you.
It's kind of like my breakfast. All brand cottage cheese, yogurt, and a little bit of fruit. I freestyle on the fruit. It could be grapes. Ooh. It actually could be strawberries. It could be whatever. I don't mind.
That's pretty healthy.
I you know, it's pretty healthy. It's a habit. 20 years and counting. Stephen, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Bruce.
Stephen Guise is the author of Elastic Habits, How to Create Smarter Habits That Adapt to Your Day.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Definitions for 200, please. Meme quote: a humor, picture, or video that is copied, changed slightly, then spread rapidly on the internet. Okay, I got that. ETF, or exchange-traded fund. An investment fund that is traded on the stock market. Okay, got it. But meme ETF? What are you talking about? I have no idea what that is. What is a meme ETF? Why do we care? Tim Renzetta joins us now. He is the co-founder of Next Gen Personal Finance, and he's in Palo Alto, California. Hello there.
Bruce, how are you?
I'm great. So a meme ETF is a basket of meme stocks. I cover everything related to finance. I know everything. I don't know what a meme stock is. What's a meme stock?
A meme stock. Well, let's take a step back for a minute here. Let's talk about how investors think about valuing stocks. And traditionally, you know, I took some accounting classes somewhere along the way in my business education. You know, we talk about earnings and we talk about multiples of earnings and we talk about discounted cash flows, and there's 15, 20 different ways to value companies. What's changed is now we're seeing stock prices being driven by the crowd. And by the crowd, I'm talking about you know, the largest group being Wall Street Bets, which is a subreddit group. And so there are actually investment themes now. You have hedge funds going into these chat rooms and looking for sentiment.
It's almost the professionalization of what the basement dwellers did with GameStop.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so,
so GameStop is an example of a meme stock.
Absolutely. Yeah. So those of you not familiar with the GameStop, it's a traditional retailer, actually a mall retailer that sold physical, you know, boxes of software around games. Right. And so that was the traditional model. Well, obviously that model, the world has changed. And now most games are being played, you know, distributed digitally or played online. However, a group within Wall Street Bets decided there were some positive changes happening at GameStop. They had a new board chair who was coming from a company called Chewy, I believe it was.
So our listeners know all about GameStop. It sounds to me like a classic pump and dump, but I wonder how you would say, so if this is the professionalization, this is then in an ETF context, a basket of GameStop and AMC and BlackBerry and whatever other ones are grabbing the headlines. Tell us how those stocks are selected. Like, there must be something more than just trolling Reddit to put names into that basket, which then forms an ETF.
That is a great question in terms of, yeah, how are they, what is that evaluation process, right? Because most ETFs traditionally were index ETFs, right? Yeah. Where S&P 500 said, the Standard & Poor's group got together and said, okay, here are the, based on market cap and some other factors, here are the largest 500. It's a good question. I think, you know, what in my mind makes a meme stock is when, yeah, it's fed by social media and there seems to be a disconnect behind what a professional investor might think a company is worth and what its value, how it's being valued in the market today. So kind of being, you know, maybe, and I should have done my research, Bruce. Maybe it's based on, you know, they can track stock trades, how much of it's coming from institutions versus retail.
Yeah.
So maybe they're looking at kind of how much is being driven by retail traders.
And there's all sorts of metrics that you and I wouldn't know from our past that would try and quantify the buzziness of things, like the number of social media mentions, the number of Reddit mentions, the number of Reddit subthreads or whatever that is. There's a couple of these out there. I think there's one, there's a new one coming, and then there's Buzz and FOMO. There's a bunch of them. How would you have investors think about the performance of an ETF like this?
Extremely speculative.
Yes. I think that was the understatement of the year.
Yeah.
Bill Gates is rich. Yes, that is true.
I think if you want to play the game, consider it entertainment and make it a very small part of your portfolio. Because, yeah, I think Warren Buffett captures the market when he talks about it. In the short run, it's a voting machine. So in the short run, it might be a social media machine, but in the long run, it's a weighing machine. What's the underlying value of the company? And it might take 1 month, it might take 6 months, it may take 2 or 3 years, but eventually we do get to that level.
Well, and I love that you use the word valuation here, because I'm sure in the world of meme stocks and meme ETFs, it's simply not about that. It's not about valuation. It's not about underlying fundamentals. It's about buzz and momentum and the spirit of the moment.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's taken, I think it's surprised a lot of people. I looked yesterday, I think GameStop was still in the $200 share range. I think what has surprised people is the persistence of this trend, which is probably why you're starting to see some financial products come out. Because, right, I think GameStop hit 483 midday in January at some point.
Yeah.
And then it crashed to about 60. And so I think a lot of people felt like, okay, that was it. But people are going to move on. The pandemic seems to be getting people out of the house. You know, all sorts of reasons that seem to draw people to meme stocks in the heart. You know, January was kind of the peak pandemic here.
You and I are not spring chickens here. So we have seen the same with cannabis stocks, with those promising a vaccine, with even back into the late 90s, anything that had the .com label attached to their to their name. So how do you think about a percentage of a portfolio for a human who is still grounded in reality? Is this the crypto fund? Like it's 3%. It's play money. It's
somewhere between 0 and 3%.
And I
don't appreciate you calling me. My son called me boomer yesterday, so I don't appreciate you.
Oh no, you're not a boomer.
I know.
By the way, listeners, I can see Tim on a Zoom window. So he lives in California. He's had a tremendous amount of work done. There is a lot of fillers and a lot of Botox happening, but I can tell that he has vivid first person memories of JFK's assassination. I can see that. Am I right?
No.
Not, but by a hair.
Let's see. What is the historical event that occurred? Actually, a day
after Pearl Harbor?
A day after I was born, a NASA rocket blew up on the launch pad. Yeah, how about that?
Okay, I'll take that. So you, Next Gen Personal Finance, tons of content related to and tools and stuff related to personal finance. How do you articulate your target audience?
Yeah. So we work with our target audience is middle and high school teachers who are teaching personal finance in schools today, because we believe the only way to reach all young people with this essential information is through the school systems. So I co-founded at NextGen in 2014, and our mission is that every high school student, when they cross that graduation stage, will have a personal finance course under their belt.
It's great. Now, I'm going to now bring it back to meme stocks, because this has the buzzy TikTok, Snapchat. Like, how do you engage with young people to say, oh my God, this is so exciting, this is so interesting, and it's 0 to 3% of a portfolio?
Yep, let's hook them, because they're interested in the stock market. We're hearing it from teachers across the country. Kids are interested in investing. So let's take that interest and let's also talk about things like index funds. And so I know these can seem like, why would a high school student ever want to learn about index funds? We created a game, because you got to, the same way a lot of these investing platforms gamify investing, well, we've created a game called Stacks, where students get to day trade. Students get the opportunity to allocate their portfolio among seven different asset classes. Meanwhile, they're competing against the computer. The computer strategy, dollar cost averaging in the index fund. The computer wins about 80% of the time. So it's an engaging game, 20 years of investing in 20 minutes. So they're getting fresh capital to invest as if it was their salary, and 10 or 15% of their pay was their investment portfolio. And so they're making these choices, and then the game ends and they kind of, the secret's revealed. It's really hard
right,
for amateurs as well as professionals to beat the market. And, you know, there's a ton of data. I think one of the most popular games here in the US is the stock market game.
Yeah.
And so I encourage anybody who teaches the stock market game to always compare how students performed against the S&P 500, but also encourage them to invest in index funds. Because if you ever Google how to win the stock market game, it's nobody's idea of responsible long-term investing.
Yeah.
It's
pennies. Great context, Tim. I'm afraid we have to leave it there. Tim Renzetta, he is the co-founder of Next Gen Personal Finance, and illuminating, as we wrap up here, the paradox of teaching young people the boring simplicity of diversification and low cost. But as you say, Tim, hooking them in with things like meme stocks and GameStop and stuff like that. All right, stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, one woman's personal journey about her money story and the lessons she learned along the way. Actor, author Monica Parker is here to talk about her memoir, Oops, I Forgot to Save Money. And it turns out I'm not alone. She's amazing. Later, increase your financial calm, your confidence around money, your clarity with Money Zen's Manisha Thakur. And don't forget, we've got a newsletter if you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, CBC Radio, CityLine, BNN, Bloomberg, this show. Please sign up. Moolala.ca is where you get it. And I will never do anything else with your email address other than send you a newsletter.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah Law, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. There is a feeling, at least among those who don't have their financial house completely in order, that they are the only ones. This is something I run into all the time. People be like, I'm the only one. Everybody else pays their credit card on time and everybody else has pre-authorized RRSP contributions set up. I'm the only one. But of course, that is not the case. And whether you are currently struggling with money or you have in the past, it is really helpful to know that you are not alone. And that is one of the goals of Monica Parker's latest book. It is called Oops, I Forgot to Save Money. And it turns out I'm not alone. Of course, she's not alone. Monica is an author, actor, screenwriter, speaker. She joins us now to talk about the book and the lessons she has learned along the way. Hello there.
Hi there. With all those titles, wouldn't you think I'd be loaded?
I know, totally. You should be loaded. And in fact, there's so many Beverly Hills references in your book. I think you're really just making this as a fabricated story, because really you've got a room at the, what is it? The Chateau Marmont. Is that what it is? Is that what it's called?
Yeah. No, but I don't.
You do not. Your bio reads like a movie plot summary in and of itself. You worked with all sorts of boldface names. You started in Glasgow. You've lived in Toronto. You lived in LA. First of all, and most importantly, who would play you in the movie of your life?
Whoa.
I know. It's the most important question. I can't even believe I didn't think of this before. It just came to me right now.
Well, I'm going with Adele because she's lost so much weight.
Oh my God, she's gorgeous. Then it would be a musical because she'd have to sing.
Well, okay, we could do that. I have.
When I grew up in Glasgow, it was the first time I went to LA. Okay, Adele, love it. Okay. What would you say imprinted on you about that? I don't know if you would call it chaotic. It reads as chaotic. What imprinted on you about managing money, given the childhood that you had?
Well, I think creative people in general, the pull to do what we love is so much stronger than the pull to do what we should. Mm. And, you know, that applies to lots of people, but it certainly applies to people who are artists. And so I think that that's a really big one. I think another one that's really huge for me is I learned nothing at the dinner table about money. It was a non-subject. And I know that that's a huge failing, because in all this research that I've done, the people who had money discussions at home with their family and where it was an unthreatening conversation have a much better sense of value about the meaning of money. Money isn't a bad thing. It's a good thing, because we need it all the time.
You were born in Scotland. You moved to Toronto. There's all sorts of, you know, stories about your mom and your dad and those relationships. And then here you are in LA. What was the money context in LA in those times? I mean, it sounds very much like feast or famine and, you know, projects come, projects go.
Well, as I've said in the book, I've made a lot of money at different times in my life because I've worked a lot. It's not about, and then of course I've made a lot of money. And then there are all those times when I haven't worked, just because that's the nature of what I do, a freelancer. And that includes every freelancer in any profession. It has a feast and famine life. And it's a life that I would not trade for anything, because I am driven I love to do many things. And a very brief story. This will shed a little light on me. I was brought into a huge manager's office when I first got to LA. And he said, well, I've seen your videos. I've seen your resume. Tell me what it is you want. And I said, well, you know those actors who work all the time, but you don't know their name? And he put his hand up. He said, excuse me? I said, yeah, like fame isn't on my radar. I like to work and I don't just want to act. I want to do this and I want to be a writer and I want to be a producer and I want to create things. Before I knew it, his hand was on my back and I was on the other side of the door. He could not equate that someone didn't want massive fame. I don't care about fame.
Right. You wanted to be more of like a Stanley Tucci who's known, always there, but not Robert Redford.
That's right. I didn't want the pressure. I can't imagine wanting fame in your life. It sounds incredibly intrusive to me. And I've had my share of famous moments where you get stopped in the grocery store. Sure. And that's nice. I just wouldn't want that burden. And I say that thinking, gee, if I had wanted it and I was there, maybe I would have had a gazillion dollars. Mm. But I'd have spent it. I'd have traveled. I'd have done things with it.
And you are quite open about some mistakes that you made. So in addition to the challenge of feast and famine and freelance life, you invested in a gold mine in northern Quebec. You bought a timeshare. What do you think made you susceptible to these ideas that a different temperament might have said, hold on, stop everything, don't do that?
Well, I'm not conservative by nature. I think, that's a good question because I wonder about this. I think there's a bit of risk taking in me. You couldn't live the life I lead if there wasn't risk taking in me.
Of course.
So, you know, I you know what? First of all, the biggest mistake, the gold thing, that came through an ex-brother-in-law. Don't ever listen to your family. Yeah. They're the best salespeople in the world and they induct their family first. So that was really a bad mistake because it was stupid. Other things that I've thought were a good idea and may have been a good idea, but maybe their timing was off or buying a timeshare was just a complete idiotic New Year's hangover moment. That was just bad. I was pressured and I was beaten up by a salesperson.
You write about being in the office of a bankruptcy trustee. What sticks with you most vividly about that meeting? The shame.
The shame. Yeah. Absolute. Desperately terrible shame. And yet it was the gift that straightened me out.
Why?
I mean, I owe nobody anything. I have money in the bank. I straighten my life out. I learned actually about impulse spending. You know, spending is often the same thing as eating. I mean, too much food, binging. They're very similar. And I've been involved with both.
Mm. Sure.
The quick fix sounds like a good idea. The thing that makes you feel good for 10 minutes makes you feel like a good idea, but the hangover ain't worth it.
In this movie starring Adele, there will be a moment and it will be a turning point moment. And screenwriter Monica would craft this moment beautifully. As you look at the facts of your life, what would that moment be? What's that turning point?
Well, definitely the bankruptcy was the horror and facing the truth. And then there comes those slow steps. Well, you know, a big turning point was just before the bankruptcy when I sat in a little tiny church. I'm not religious, but I went into this little tiny church and I needed to sit still and have a chat with myself. And there was a chipped Jesus and I had a chat with him and he didn't answer to me, but just the fact that I was putting it all out there alone in this tiny little church in Los Angeles, where you wouldn't imagine there'd be a little brown wooden church, but there was. And I think it sort of was a great moment, a confession for myself. And once it was out of my body, I could look at it. And then I went, no, I don't want to be that person. I'm better than that.
Yeah.
I'm smarter than that.
Yeah.
And that's what changed. So that's the moment.
And there was still work to do. You have a phrase in the book that is simple and true, quote, managing money was harder than I thought it would be. So you had this moment and then you had to like buckle down and do all the work. What was the hardest part in the land of doing? So you had the insight, which altered, it sounds like it just altered your paradigm and your outlook. And then you had to do stuff.
I had to take stock of what I had spent money on. Mm. And I make a list in the book of the things that, you know, again, in the same way that chocolate satisfies for a short moment, so did a lipstick. It wasn't a lot of money, but did I need 56 lipsticks? Probably not. Did I need all those shoes? No. So I started to look at that kind of excess and I went, this is just Band-Aids. I don't need Band-Aids. I'm strong. I can push through this. I actually just need what I need. And, you know, I am not a person who doesn't have pretty things around me because that's part of living a lovely life. So I do, I indulge a bit in art, but it's not massively expensive. It's things that please me. Mm. I think pretty surroundings are very nice, but what I've also learned is I don't need everything. That's a shocking thing to have thought you once did.
I wish we had more time, Monica, but thank you for joining us to talk about your book and your story. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce. I think you're amazing. I love what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you. Monica Parker, her list of skills and experience is very, very long, but the number one thing you need to take away is the title of her book. It is, Oops, I Forgot to Save Money. And it turns out I'm not alone. If you're looking for an entertaining and engaging and empathetic read, you should pick up that book.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, we'll talk to Manisha Thakur from Money Zen about her 5 tips for increasing financial calm. It just makes me calmer even just knowing that she's coming up on the show. But first, we're going to put a spotlight on something that makes people very anxious. How's that for the antithesis of what Manisha is going to talk about? Amanda Doucette will be here. She hosts something called the Tax Chick Podcast. Taxes, I know. If this is not enough moolala for you, you can listen to past episodes of the show, and you can do that in 2 ways. One is on the website, moolala.ca. There's a little button that says Buy Media. You go to the podcast, you can listen to whole episodes, or you can search by keywords. So maybe you want to think about debt, or maybe there's a guest you know we've interviewed or whatever. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms out there. So, you know, whichever one you use, Spotify, Amazon Prime, whatever, and just download the show. While you're there, subscribe to it so the next episode just shows up.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Moolah Law has been profiling bloggers and podcasters and TikTokers and all that for really since the show began, because we believe that the more voices, the better. Different perspectives on all the different aspects of money. And today we're going to be talking about tax, which is, I was going to say one of my least favorite topics, but for today, let's call it my least favorite topic of all things that touch our bank account. I'll say that tax is my least favorite. And our next guest has probably heard that before. Amanda Doucette hosts the Tax Chick Podcast. She joins us from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
You've heard this before, haven't you? People hate tax.
Challenge accepted. I will change your mind in the next 8 minutes.
I love it. I love it. And I have been filing taxes since I was 14 because I had earned income in those days. What was your moment? What was your moment? You didn't grow up loving spreadsheets despite the fact that you were surrounded by them. What was your moment where you realized, oh, this is my world. These are my people.
Well, I think it was about 2 months into practicing as a lawyer. I was trying to make it as a family law civil litigation lawyer, and I just felt, ugh. And one day a partner came down the hall and said, hey, do you want to try tax litigation? And I said, I'm really bad at math. Is that okay? And he said, yeah, it's fine. And I dived into this world and I just fell in love. And why I fell in love with it is I love a challenge. And I love to take a complex problem and break it down. And I feel like sometimes people make tax more complicated than it needs to be. And so I really enjoy working with my clients to uncomplicate the complicated.
It must make it easier for you to engage with clients because of your shared disdain or I don't know what the word is, disdain for math, trauma with math, history with math. That is very, very common in our culture.
It really is. And I find sometimes it does help because I do have that shared feeling with a lot of my clients. So, you know, we'll pull out a spreadsheet, we'll both take a deep breath together, and then we'll dive into it. And I think because I have difficulty or find it frustrating to review information in that way, I can be creative and come up with different ways to provide the information. I mean, I can do math. I can handle a spreadsheet, but I think that there are other ways of presenting information. And so I've really enjoyed that over the years.
For example, do you have a whiteboard with colored markers? Do you draw pictures? Is there animation? How do you talk about math, or how do you look at tax differently?
I love a good picture. I'm all about a picture. And I think it's because I'm always doodling as I'm talking. And so we recently got a smart board at the office not long ago. And so there's only two different colors. I really wish there was more than two, but there's different colors, and I can draw pictures and I can point at things. And I find if clients think about their businesses as buckets or as boxes, and we talk about what's in each box and we can draw arrows between the boxes, that really helps people to connect the dots.
Tax goes to the government. It goes to government coffers. As you draw an emoji to represent that bucket, what do you draw? Is it a friendly emoji? Is it a scary emoji?
Sometimes it's a facepalm emoji. Depends how much is going in that bucket, Bruce.
Right. Right. And do clients typically come to you, be honest with me, proactively thinking about how do I navigate this part of my business? Or are 80% of your people, not only did they have a facepalm, they actually have a bruise because they've facepalmed themselves so many times because of maybe mistakes that they have made in navigating that bucket?
Well, I've often said I can be the fence at the top or the ambulance at the bottom. I would much prefer to be the fence. And over the years, part of what caused me to create the podcast and write a blog is I'm really trying to encourage people to become more proactive and not to be afraid to have these discussions. And I found that over the last couple of years, my client base is moving towards more proactivity, which I really enjoy. Because when we plan, that's fun. Then we have options and we can learn. When something has happened, we're now in triage mode and it's not as much fun. In fact, it can be quite scary sometimes. And so I'd rather be there with you and supporting you through the fun part, but I can also be there to triage with you if need be.
To mix our metaphors here, there's that expression, nothing's more certain than death and taxes. So there's a certainty that someone's going to have to navigate the tax bucket or deal with the tax bucket. You're just trying to get ahead of it.
Well, and I think often there's too much of a focus on tax, which is maybe a strange thing to say as a tax lawyer.
God, you're going to have to rebrand your tax podcast, tax chick podcast. You're going to have to call it like baking tips with the tax chick.
I could do that. I have all my Wilton courses, but in terms of taxes, I mean, I think that it's important for clients to understand that there's tax reasons to do things and non-tax reasons to do things. And just because you can save tax by going down one route, that doesn't mean that's the best route for you. And so I think it's important for people to understand that there's always options, and it's okay to choose the option that makes you pay more tax. You just need to understand what option that you've chosen and know that the other good things coming out of that option are better for you.
Tax Chick is the name of the podcast. I was listening to Bookkeeping 101, and I love the groovy music your husband created for the opening. Delightful. You seem like a natural, honestly, as I was listening to your demeanor as the host of the show, you really seem like a natural. How did this come to be?
I've always been a talker. I think that's something I've been since I was young. And I love communicating and I love having curious conversations with people. And so before I had the podcast, I was having these conversations, but I was having them privately and nobody else got to be a part of them. And so during the pandemic, it just felt like there was a need to have connection and to really provide some support, especially for Canadian business owners who were going through so much and still are going through so much. And so I thought it would be a really cool way to sort of share those conversations with the world and then also collaborate with my husband. It was really fun for him to create that music. And he's got some new music coming out again for me soon. And it's been a fun project.
How would you describe your view of tax collectors, the CRA or whatever that? Because a lot of times, I'm sure people come into your office and they see that person or that institution as out to get them or trying to, you know, take their hard-earned cash or whatever. Do you have a more empowering paradigm that you create for your clients to disarm that negativity?
I feel like you just set me up there, Bruce. I feel like I have to come up with something empowering.
You totally do. It can be an episode, but
I think it kind of goes back to the proactivity again. So are there bad apples within Canada Revenue Agency? Sure, there's bad apples in every profession and every organization. But oftentimes the way I like to sort of deal with my clients is say, they're doing their job, just like you're doing your job. And so there's no point in being antagonistic. We need to work within the system. And so I think it's important to sort of remind clients that they have rights, but they also have responsibilities. And that they're not alone in this, and that it's not that, you know, something horrible is going to happen to them. As long as we continue to be proactive and we respond within the confines of the law, it will be okay. And so I think sometimes clients just need to hear that it's going to be okay and that there are options and there are solutions.
What do you think is the most common misconception about tax? If you were to look at the very tippy top of that list, what would be there?
I think the most common misconception is that the only people who can understand tax are people who work in math and accounting.
And really everyone can?
Everybody can understand the basic foundational principles of tax. And tax is fascinating. Tax is tied to policy. It's tied to social programming. It's tied to government. It changes with the winds depending on, you know, where things are at in modern society. It is so cool. And so if you change the lens of the way that you think about tax to think about it as something cool, well, suddenly now it becomes a curiosity, something you can look into and anybody can learn about it.
Anybody can, and they should learn it from you. Amanda, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Bruce.
Amanda Doucette hosts the Tax Chick podcast. It's delightful. You're going to learn all sorts of stuff from the person who says she is the fence, not the ambulance. I love that. Stay with us. Coming up next, this is a logical segue. 5 tips for increasing your financial calm. Money Zen's Manisha Thakur will be here. And don't forget, if you've got any questions for us, listen, if they're tax questions, I'm going to send them to Amanda. But if they're other questions, I'll answer them myself. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca, moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I love that we chose the perky music for this particular introduction. We do have lots of different musical choices, but we chose the perfect one to set up an interview about calm. We should have had Zamfir Magic of the Pan Flute instead. When you think of your money, are you thinking like calm, deep breath, namaste thoughts, or are you internally freaking out? Most people at a certain level are picking the latter. So we have some tips. Manisha Thakur is the founder of Money Zen. She's in Belgrade, Maine today to talk about her 5 tips to increase your financial calm, confidence, and clarity. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
What does it mean to be financially calm? Is that even possible?
So when I say you are financially calm, what I mean, and I put them all together, calm, confidence, and clarity, because they're like strings on a pearl or notches on a belt. And the way I think about it is that you want to be in a situation where when you have to make day-to-day decisions about that involve money, whether they're small ones or big ones, you don't feel any stress about making that decision because you have clarity around your finances. And you have confidence in your knowledge of what will be happening depending on how you decide to act with your money. And when those three things come together, then I feel like people are in a state of money zen.
Right. And it doesn't mean that they don't have divorce or health issues or job loss, but boy, it sounds like they'd be better equipped to handle all those circumstances.
Oh, precisely. I mean, life spits in everybody's eye. And I mean, I recently, you know, I'm a divorced 51-year-old workaholic who...
is that your dating profile?
Exactly. On Tinder, it says... Yeah.
Swipe right if you want some of this.
And, you know... And recently I had a pretty long health issue that now thankfully is resolved. And I mean, I didn't expect any of this. This is not what I thought would happen to me by this stage in my life. And so stuff happens to all of us and we can't plan that, but we can prepare to be able to deal with it. And it's about the money, but it's also about the mindset.
Mm. Yeah. You've got some tips. What is tip number one to... I don't know if we say increase your financial calm, find your financial calm, develop your financial calm.
Develop, I think, is the best way to put it. And the first tip I have is from my grandfather in India. And he used to say, buy few, but buy the best you can afford at that time with the money you have with cash. You're not taking out debt for it.
Right.
And I really noticed this when I, 25 plus years ago, when I was spent my junior year abroad at Oxford, I came over like the typical American with this freaking huge set of gigantic Samsonite suitcases to move into my little tiny dorm room. And my British peers came in with almost nothing. I looked like the entire year, and they were impeccably dressed because they had like two phenomenal sweaters that will last them a lifetime and always look brand new. And I had just, you know, typical disposable clothing.
Right.
And so buy a few things. And I have, just to wrap this point up, my aunt in India, my grandfather's daughter, she bought me a shawl when I was 18 years old. She took me to a shop and said I could get any pashmina I wanted. I picked one, turned out to be the most expensive one in the shop, and I thought she was going to dry heave. I have taken that shawl on every single business trip I have had since then. Like, how many decades is that? And it always looks new.
Wow. Okay. Number two is the 50-30-20 principle. What is it, people who don't know, and why do you believe in it?
So 50-30-20 refers to the optimal or an ideal touchstone of the allocation of your take-home pay, with 50% of your money going towards needs, 30% towards wants, and 20% towards savings, which encompasses near, medium, and long-term savings. So an emergency fund, nearer-term things like a vacation or home repairs, and then longer-term retirement. And it's not that everybody is going to live 50-30-20. If you live in a major metropolitan area, sometimes there's no way you can keep your needs, which I would call housing, transportation, food, insurance, and any mandatory childcare in order to work. In some parts of the world, you have to, I mean, it eats up 70% of your take-home pay. And so the point of 50-30-20 is then to highlight, well, if that's the case, something has to go. And usually it's savings and it drops to zero. But could you not find a different shift in percentages between the wants and the savings so that you are enjoying today and establishing some security for tomorrow?
Next up is lifestyle creep, which, you know, it's relevant at all stages of life, but in particular for younger people as they move from student life of, you know, ramen noodles and fast fashion to, oh my gosh, I have an actual paycheck here.
Yes. Oh my God. So lifestyle creep is this: you go and you buy a great new top, and then you go home and you look at yourself in the mirror and you're like, okay, that doesn't go with these pants and shoes. So you go get those. And then you come home and you're like, oh, wait a minute, this doesn't go with this home. So then you give me a new apartment upgrade. And then you're watching TV and you're like, oh, I can't wear this outfit in this apartment with that TV. And so it's just this slow creep. And what happens often for young people that I know is that many college campuses these days have gyms and student centers that are nicer than any facility I was able to afford to work out in until I was like in my late 30s. And so the other piece that you have, whether it's comparison to the college campus, comparison to what you see on social media, is unrealistic expectations that's just fuel for that lifestyle creep fire.
The next one is about relationships. Now, you, as you mentioned, you're divorced. You've got some cred in this area because you learned some things, I am sure.
You know, I will tell you, my ex and I are on extremely good terms. We did not argue about money when we got divorced. Part of it is because I asked for a prenup. I was his second wife and he had children from prior marriage, and I didn't want them to think I was a gold digger, because I was doing quite well on my own. And so we had a prenup, and we talked a lot about money. That is exceptionally rare. And my advice is this: do not get married if you have not talked about money. I mean, I meet people who are married and they don't know what their spouse earns. Mm-hmm. And money, according to the American Psychological Association, every single year is one of the top two causes of fights, stress, and divorce in relationships. So it's a skill set that we all need to learn. And if you haven't learned it, read my book, Get Financially Naked, How to Talk Money with Your Honey.
Yes. Now, we just had a minute left here. You and I have both been in this world for a very, very long time. What would you say is the, of these five, the one that you need to keep revisiting or keep top of mind, or that is the most resonant for you as you look to the future versus the things you've learned in the past?
Without a doubt, it is tip number five, which is set boundaries to have real freedom. And what I mean by that is, for instance, I have this hankering to buy a place here in Maine. And so I've set a dollar amount and I will not look at any properties over that amount. And it gives me such freedom because now I'm not craving stuff I can't afford or a lifestyle I'm not going to be able to live. And sometimes your boundaries are, you know, I'm not hanging out with those friends because they always want to go to the super expensive restaurant and order the really expensive wine and I'm sober. So creating the right sense of a set of boundaries around things that could involve money will literally set you free, and you constantly need to revisit what are those possible areas of stress.
So good. So good. My answer would be around the clarity of making sure that I've got clarity around the 50, 30, 20, because, and this is going to sound like a humble brag, I'm an underspender. And so I'm basically, you know, those clothes that we had in university, even though they were fast fashion at the time, I still wear them on a night out because I'm like, what? Anyway, that's probably more information than our listeners need. I'm not perfect either, everyone. It's true. Manisha, thank you so much for your time.
It's always a pleasure.
Manisha Thakur is the founder of Money Zen. She's looking out at the ocean from Belgrade, Maine, and is probably going to buy a place in the next week. There, I'm putting that out into the universe.
Yes. For you. Yes. That's,
yeah, in the next week. Totally done.
If you want to know what I'm up to with the house, go to moneyzen.com, sign up for my newsletter where I'll be talking about how this saga unfolds.
There's going to be pictures there too, I bet. I hope so.
Yes.
Thank you again. Thank you again.
Take care, okay. Bruce.
That is our show for today, everyone. Thanks to our sponsor, Credit Canada. That is Canada's first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. So thanks to them. And If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, you sign up for Manisha's Money Zen newsletter. Also sign up for Moolala. You can go to moolala.ca and you'll get information about the podcast, the radio show, CBC, CityLine, all the stuff that's going on. On social media, you can find me at Bruce Celery on Twitter, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us and have a great day.